Good afternoon, folks. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And note for the record that today is Tuesday. Nope, no, that's wrong.
Thursday, May the 10th.
Today is Thursday, May the 10th, 2007, and members present are Senators Davis, Ellis, and Stevens.
Senator McGuire is currently in judiciary at the moment. She's on call to see if I'll get here.
Okay. I'd like to note that we have a quorum present to do business, and for any members of the public who are interested, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska bills that were previously noticed for our committee, we have arranged with the Finance Committee for those bills to go directly there and catch up with an RCA extension bill that was already in the Finance Committee. So those House bills have gone on to Finance. Also, the bills that were noticed for today under bills previously scheduled, tourism disclosure and notice and real estate brokers and salespersons, Senate Bill 165 and House Bill 205, passed out on Tuesday. So if you're here for those bills, the bills moved on to the next committee of referral. So today before us, we have a full plate. We have three bills. First, Senate Bill 170, insurance coverage for well baby exams, sponsored by Senator McGuire, followed by House Bill 14, restricting access to alcohol, by Representative Crawford. And finally, House Bill 113, optometrist use of pharmaceuticals, sponsored by Representative Samuels. So we understand that Senator McGuire is giving testimony or participating in another committee hearing, but she has several staffers. Is one of them on the way?
Presumably.
Okay. Okay, let's hold a minute to see if we can't get someone from Senator McGuire's office here.
What? They lost that again.
Uh-huh. That's Senate Bill 170. Yes, please go ahead and join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do apologize for being late. We had a bill up in House Judiciary as well, so that's where the sponsor
is. That time of year. Senate Bill 170 is before us, insurance coverage for well baby exams. Please go identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Marit Carlson Van Dort, staff to Senator McGuire, here to speak this afternoon on Senate Bill 170, an act relating to well baby exams. And forgive me for being out of breath. Senate Bill 170 would require private health insurance plans to include in their standard coverage for dependents well baby exams. These exams are considered to be a routine pediatric part of routine pediatric health care and supervision, and generally each visit costs between about $125 to $250, not including immunizations. This bill, as written, will require well baby exam coverage for infants during their first 24 months of life. These exams would include monitoring development and growth rate, hearing, vision, language skills, motor development, diet, and general preventative health care, as well as infectious diseases. These exams would provide a cost-effective way to ensure a child's good health by preventative intervention. So as opposed to addressing, you know, the child when he's in the ER and very, very sick with a high fever, we could perhaps prevent that ER visit with good monitoring. And I might also add that there's about 21 other states that require commercial insurance companies to cover some level of child of baby child care, well child care, I should say. So with that.
Okay, Ms. Carlson Van Dort, thank you very much for your initial presentation. Are there questions or comments from the committee members? If not, thank you. Thank you for sticking with us here.
And Mr. Yep. Chairman, if I
please
might ask, did you get the CS?
We did.
Okay, great.
So that,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Can you tell me the cost of this, though? I mean, someone's going to pay it, right?
Yes.
The bill provides that these exams would be subject to standard policy provisions applicable to other benefits, including deductible or co-payment provisions. So it would likely be borne either by the insurance companies or they would pass it along in higher premiums.
So how much are we talking about?
Well, each child, again, the visits vary from pediatrician to pediatrician, about $150 to $250. And the general recommendations, I think those children are seen, I would say, a minimum of 6 times per their first year of life. I myself am not a mother, so I haven't been through the loop, but I would say at least $1,500 or around $1,500 a year.
Well, my point is that there's no free lunch. Someone's going to pay for it, and I'm asking you how much it's going to cost. Someone, whoever's going to be paying for it, is going to be a substantial amount of money, right?
Well, through the chair, Senator Stevens, I guess it's a matter of opinion if approximately $1,500 or so per year is a substantial amount of money. It would be borne by the insurance companies who may or may not choose to pass that along in a higher premium rate.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate it, but you haven't answered my question at all. So thanks very much for trying.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Stevens. Anything else for the sponsor's representative? If not, thank you, ma'am, for being with us. Or actually, no,
yes.
I meant the committee members now have a committee substitute before us. Could you run us through the changes made in that? Committee staff's going to make sure we all have that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that.
Hang on just a minute until we get Senator.
Sure.
Okay. We now all have the CS. Please let us know the changes from the original bill proposed here.
Mr. Chairman, what was stricken from the original bill was page 1, lines 10 and 11, which is coverage for well baby exams under this section is limited to $1,500 a year for each covered baby. And we chose to remove those two lines because we wouldn't want to unduly mandate a limit which may or may not already exist, depending on the insurance carrier.
Okay. So the original bill had a cap, and you're proposing in the CS to remove the cap on the cost.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. We're going to hold off consideration on the CS at this time and go on to Stephanie Birch. Stephanie, are you here or online?
I'm online. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Please identify yourself and affiliation for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Stephanie Birch, B-I-R-C-H. I'm a nurse with 25 years of experience with a master's in public health in nursing, and I'm a family nurse practitioner. I'm here representing the Department of Health and Social Services as the section chief for women's, children's, and family health in the Division of Public Health. My testimony is available in print as well, so I can send this down for the record if you'd like. The foundation of periodic and regular visits to a health care provider during the first 2 years of life is more commonly termed as health supervision, and so for my testimony, I'm going to be referring to it as health supervision. The foundation of health supervision visits is not only screening and assessment, but more importantly, health promotion and anticipatory guidance. Thus, the focus of these visits is not just prevention or treating illness or injury, but actively promoting the physical, emotional, mental, and social well-being of children and their new parents. Using questions such as those outlined in Bright Future material developed by, in coordination with Health and Human Services and the American Academy of Pediatrics, this material is commonly used by healthcare providers who care for children, with each health supervision visit seeking a thorough assessment of the health of the newborn and child, enhancing the child's development over time, and educating and supporting the child's family and child rearing practices. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends newborns through age 2 receive a total of 10 visits, with 7 of these occurring in the first year of life. The schedule of these visits reflects the anticipated developmental milestones that most children will demonstrate at a given period of time as they mature. In addition, many of the scheduled visits occur in coordination with the recommended immunization schedule, so that families have their visits coordinated. Health supervision visits generally include a health interview or history, an assessment by a healthcare provider of the physiological, emotional, cognitive, and social development, which also includes developmental milestones. There's also observation of parent-child interactions, a physical examination head-to-toe, screening procedures, and an evaluation of strengths and issues within the parent-child relationship. The intent really is for parents to participate as full partners in health supervision visits. These families who establish long-term trusting relationships with a primary health care provider tend to receive continuous, coordinated, and comprehensive care. Their use of the services is much more appropriate and cost-effective. In addition, many, many studies have shown that children in a medical home utilize emergency rooms less often, have less of a tendency to doctor shop, and are less likely to have issues of child abuse or neglect. In addition, developmental lags are much more quickly identified, and children are referred in a more timely manner for community-based or specialty services when actively participating in a medical home. In closing, the Department of Health and Social Services supports the essence of Senate Bill 170 regarding well child or health supervision visits for the first 2 years of life, as it will set a pattern for regular screening and assessment and assist in establishing a relationship with consistent health care provider and a medical home. Thank you.
Ms. Birch, thank you for your testimony and being with us today. I'll note for the record that Senator Bundy has joined the committee and welcome Senator McGuire before Senate Labor and Commerce. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much. My apologies. I had a bill up in House Judiciary.
No, we understand. It's that time of year. Appreciate you being here. Any questions or comments for Ms. Birch? If not, thank you again for being with us. Is there anyone here in the room or anyone else online to testify on this legislation? Senator McGuire, if we could go back to you, there was a question posed by Senator Stevens regarding the true cost of the well-baby exams, and there was a $1,500 figure, and we've talked about the committee substitute that has a removal of the cap from your original bill, and your staff gave an answer, and I think we needed to explore that a little more from the labor and commerce perspective of businesses or insurance companies or consumers ultimately bearing these additional costs.
Sure. That's a very fair question. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, you might be surprised to know that most private health care plans do offer well baby exams. So for the individuals in our community that pay insurance premiums, they reflect coverage of the well baby exams in most instances. Really what this bill is doing is trying to catch a few of those that may not, because it's a recognition that the cost of a sick baby is much higher. And so I would submit to the committee that insurance premiums are not an exact science. Frankly, they are made up of actuarial evidence about the propensity for certain risks, the number of people within each individual pool. There are all kinds of calculations, so it's a very difficult question for me to answer, but I can tell you I have thought about it quite a bit, and I wouldn't have introduced the bill if I did not think that the net gain to both the insurance recipient and the pool would be greater by providing for the well baby exams to mitigate the disastrous consequences of, for example, a baby coming up with meningitis or ending up with malnutrition to the point that they have to be put on an IV in an emergency room setting to the tune of 20 or 30,000. So most private insurance companies do this, but this is sort of the cleanup catch-all. And again, I don't know if Mara brought this other point up, but and I know the physician online did. This is a very important, being a new mom and an educated new mom, there were things that I learned in my well baby exams that frankly I didn't know. And I, without getting, if this makes anybody uncomfortable, I breastfed, and learning that process and whether or not your baby's getting enough nutrition and is the right weight and all those things are very important. And in point of fact, I struggled with that a little bit in the first well baby exam. And so, you know, we know that if children don't get the proper nutrition, The brains and the synapses do not develop properly, and there are long-term consequences for that, as well as obviously the ability for a physician to sort of look the baby over and cut off the pass any potential birth defects that are developing, and certainly the inoculations themselves. So they're about, I can tell you, they're about $110. That's what they are, and there's a set schedule that's really recommended under state law. They say recommended, but in reality, you can't put a child in a state-licensed daycare facility or in a school system without having met those inoculation guidelines. So they're recommended, quote-unquote, but in reality, that everyone knows you have to meet them.
And Senator, did you want to speak to the elimination of the cap that's in the $1,500 cap that's in the proposed committee substitute?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do. And this was actually at the suggestion of Linda Hall, who pointed out that because some private insurance plans have already decided that this was a good investment, they may cover more than that. And we don't want to have the reverse effect of cutting off benefits that mothers and babies and families may already be receiving. And one other point to Senator Stevens as well, you know, Denali KidCare covers up to a certain point. And then there's this gap of people in America and in Alaska in general. They're working hard, they're trying to make ends meet, but they don't quite, they're not quite there. And so, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a health plan, what we're saying is please cover the well baby exams. That's, you know, and again, as Senator Davis said on the floor, if you can't help your kids and their health, then, you know, where are we? So.
Other comments or questions for the sponsor? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I read in the sponsor statement that this is to require private health insurance plans. What's the practice of the state's insurance coverage?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up through the chair, Senator Bundy. As this bill continues to work its way through, I will continue my negotiations. I would welcome a statement of intent, legislative intent by this committee, that it is the intent that the state administered, any state administered plan cover well baby exams. We have been working on this over the last couple weeks, and it's a very, this is one of the big problem areas. All of the women in this building and elsewhere that are covered know that well baby exams are not covered by the state of Alaska's insurance company right now. And it's a subject of a lot of discontent. And so we are looking at a way to do that. It's an oddity. The state, you know, as I was joking earlier, but the state exempts itself from anything that's meaningful sometimes, you know. If it's an OSHA law, then everybody else has to comply except the state. But this is one of those cases where it appears that the state has carved out an area of exception. And so we're working right now to try to fix that. But I would welcome if this committee felt it was in order. If not, if you'd allow me to let my bill keep moving through the process, clearly it won't be able to pass this year, but I'd like to keep moving through and keep the pressure on the bill itself. I would really like to have the state recognize well baby exams as well.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. It does seem somewhat inconsistent that we would require private enterprise to adopt a standard that the state chooses not to adopt. That would, of course, then engender a fiscal note, however, because I don't know what the impact was on the state semi-self-insuring that we do. So it would be interesting to know what the fiscal impact would be.
And I would welcome that. And I don't disagree, Senator Bundy, that the original intent of the bill was not to distinguish between the two. And frankly, though, what I've learned in my research is it is the private companies that really, for the most part, are offering them. And frankly, the state is one of the bad actors in this arena. And so I welcome their fiscal note, should there be one. Again, I have my very strong belief, again, that a state-insured individual who has a child and does not go through well-baby exams runs a very high risk that their child is going to end up at some point with a serious illness and be in the hospital in the emergency room, which would be covered, and all of you would be paying for that.
Senator McGuire, we don't at this time have a letter of intent prepared, so I guess you wouldn't mind if it were, a letter of intent can come from any of the committees that. This is the first committee referral. There's also a referral to the HESS committee and then on to finance. So anywhere in the process, a letter of intent can accompany the bill. I'm confident that that will happen. And I like to think of the state as, in this regard, maybe as a slow actor
slow
as opposed to a bad
better.
Actor.
You're right, Mr.
We're gonna
That's
we're gonna
a better way
hope
to
they
it.
Come around and we all do the right thing.
Yes.
Was there, Senator Stevens? Did I see your hand for a question?
No. Do you have people to testify? Or?
No. That was. I'll call again. Is there anyone else besides Ms. Birch online or here in the room who would like to testify? Senator Bundy?
Yeah, I'm not sure the mechanism, Mr. Chairman, but letters of intent get ignored at little peril. Could it be not written into the legislation that it is that there shall be well baby exams, period?
I would love it.
It could be.
And it would be intent language, so it would not be law, but it would send a very strong message.
Senator Stevens, and then I'm going to move us toward consideration of the proposed committee substitute.
Oh, thank you, sir. I just glanced through my packet, came across a letter from the NFIB, National Federation of Independent Businessmen, calling this an unfunded mandate that small businesses, of course, cover the cost of health insurance, and that this more rightly might be handled between discussions between employees and employers. Do you have any response to that?
I do, Senator Stevens, through the chair. You know, whenever you are interjecting yourself into the area of insurance, it is you can expect those kind of letters. In fact, I think if you would look back when the diabetes coverage was put in by Senator Representative Murkowski, then Representative, now Senator, same kind of letters are issued. I can't disagree with their philosophical position or right to defend it. Respectfully, sometimes it does take public policy to encourage insurance companies to do the right thing. And again, I'm sitting back in a reasoned analysis looking at what I have observed as a mother, what I have observed in the medical community, what I have observed from other mothers, and it's just a common sense provision that you know that this is going to be the kind of thing that will pay off in spades, because one visit to the emergency room these days is in the $30,000 figure. Respectfully, there are places for those negotiations to take place between an employer and employee, but frankly, when it comes to some of these other issues, it is not inappropriate for the government to make a policy that they think is important, and frankly, sometimes that enhances the negotiating position for employees. So no different than some of the workplace laws, for example. I just would submit that I respectfully have read the letter, and I would anticipate that on any mandatory insurance coverage. I think you're going to get the same letters all the time with a different bill number.
Okay. So at this time, we have a proposed committee substitute. It's the Bailey /C version that each member should have. We've talked about it. It's the removal of the cap and not try and limit anything. Sounds like it has the Linda Hall stamp of approval. So is there any discussion of, well, can I, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the proposed committee substitute.
I'll move that.
Okay, thank you, Senator Davis. That's before us for discussion. Is there discussion of the proposed committee substitute? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the committee substitute is adopted as the item before us. And now I'll call for, well, I've already done it twice. I guess we've completed the public testimony. I'll close the public hearing on this legislation, which brings the bill before us. For myself, I understand the issues involved in the bill. I think we've heard an interest today to explore in this committee or a next committee of referral a letter of intent or putting intent language into the body of the bill, or even going as far as including the state in the legislation, which does trigger, has its ramifications for the bill. The question is, would we want to do that work in this committee or in the HES committee. I'm happy to accommodate the wills of the will of the committee.
The next referral on this bill is to HES committee.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'd be willing to take that up in my committee if it's okay with you.
Okay. I think we'd appreciate that.
Great.
So there's a willing partner to work on some of these issues. Senator McGuire, I think you know what you have cut out for you to move this through the process and address all the members' concerns. So I personally have a willingness to allow this bill to move forward and for the work to be grappled with in the HES committee. Is there any further discussion of this bill at this time?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Stevens.
I am very uncomfortable with this. Uncomfortable with saddling industry business with these additional costs. An issue that really should be determined by employers and employees deciding what to do. I mean, I certainly love babies. I have nothing against babies. I have three of my own who have grown up. But when I asked the question how much and who pays, I never got a good answer to that. How much are we talking about? An enormous amount of money, apparently $1,500 per child. How many kids are there? I don't know. Are we going to stuff this into another? I mean, not that I love insurance companies either, but we're going to force them to pay this, or we're going to force the employer to pay it. I'm just and the whole issue of just requiring it of private industry, not of the state. I think this is a bigger issue and. It's just for your benefit, Mr. Chairman, I'm uncomfortable with this, and I'm not ready to vote yes on it.
Okay. You take an Eddie and see if I can get Bundy back in the room.
Could I just speak to that, your unreadiness a little bit?
Certainly. Senator Davis?
I think I understand pretty much where you're coming from, but in the long run, I think we'd be better off with this bill than we would without it, because many insurance companies, that is private insurance companies, already provide that. There are some of those that's out there that's not doing it and won't do it unless someone insists that they do. And as far as leaving it up to the employer or the employee to make that decision, it's probably not going to get made. And we're supposed to be on this regime to do preventive type procedures that's going to keep us from having a larger bill further on down the line when the child is actually real sick. We would be doing a good step in that direction by passing a bill such as this. So that not just some insurance companies would pick it up, but all of them would pick it up. If they picked this up and if it was something else that they wanted to drop off, and I'm not really sure what the company is going to do, because I didn't realize that you didn't have coverage here at the state. I thought it was covered by the state. And if we don't cover them, then we should. But we're never going to get this resolved if we just leave it up to the employer and the employee to make that decision. Most employees would want that. And maybe their employer might feel that it would run the insurance up too high and they might not want it. But it could be worked out. So if we don't take a stand, you know, it won't get done.
So needless to say, there's strong convictions regarding the bill. This is good instruction, I think, for Senator McGuire and the work ahead. The question really is where the additional work on this legislation, the things that we brought up before as issues, will be examined. And so I, as chair, am willing to entertain a motion to move the bill at this time with the understanding well, we know the referral to the HES committee and that additional work will be done there and that the bill has to gain enough support to move forward. I didn't want to just draw a line to the work on this bill at this time. So we have two other bills before us. I am open to a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations.
Well, I'd like to make a motion that we move CS for CS 170. With individual recommendation.
Okay. Is there any...
Zero. It's a note on it.
Okay. Any discussion of the motion? There has...
I'll object to that,
Senator.
Only because I think this is the committee it should be worked in. This is labor and commerce. We're going to be looking at raising the insurance cost to business throughout the state, and where else is it good to look at that other than in labor and commerce committee? So I don't think it should be moved out at this point.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Bundy?
Well, I still maintain my concern that the state is not involved, and we've got to expand that pool. But if, as the chair attests, it's here, if I had some assurance that that would be, and it, I know it's the sponsor shaking your head, that that will be addressed, that raises my comfort level with the bill.
Okay. Any further discussion? Thank you all for expressing your forthright opinions on the bill. At this time, we'll staff will take the roll. Call of the committee.
Senator Hoffman? Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Ellis?
Yes. So the bill moves on to the next
Thank
committee referral.
Thank you very
referral.
Much. And I will work on getting more hard numbers for you, Senator
yes.
Stevens. I assure you.
Thank you, Senator McGuire and staff.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that brings us now to House Bill 14, Restricting Access to Alcohol. And we have a representative of the sponsor, Representative Harry Crawford. Ms. Beatty, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record and give the initial presentation on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Heather Beatty, and I am staff to Representative Harry Crawford. Representative Crawford sends his apologies. He's testifying on another piece of legislation in another committee. He may be able to join us at some point. House Bill 14 was introduced in an effort to find a new approach to reducing the number of drunk driving injuries and fatalities in Alaska. The way it would work is that when a judge or parole board issues an order that a convicted drunk driver not consume alcohol, a mark would be placed on that person's driver's license or state ID card. This mark would let bars, liquor stores, and clubs know that that person is prohibited from consuming alcohol. And if the person makes an attempt to purchase alcohol, they could face a $1,000 penalty collected by the bar or liquor store that catches them trying to make that illegal purchase. The $1,000 civil penalty is modeled after the penalties that are currently out there for minors attempting to purchase or people who attempt to purchase alcohol on behalf of a minor. The legislation has received broad support, including a unanimous vote of support by the House of Representatives. There are letters of support in your packet from the cabaret, hotel, and restaurant retailers. Representative Crawford worked closely with them this summer addressing any of their concerns. And there's also a letter of support from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Alaska Mental Health Board.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Beatty. Any questions or comments for the presenter? I would note, let me ask you this. This morning I sat in on a meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee, and there was a bill heard by Representative Ramirez about vertical and horizontal configurations of the of IDs and a test at the age of 21 for mm-hmm. young people who are driving and coming of drinking age, and a special test for them. How does this bill, is there any interplay between this legislation and that legislation?
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with Representative Ramirez's proposal, but I could explain to you how we envision this working. And that is, if you look at your license, there's a navy blue background on most licenses. There's a stripe kind of in the middle of your license that has a navy blue background. And on these licenses for the drunk drivers who've been court ordered not to drink, that stripe would be red. For example, persons holding a commercial driver's license, that stripe is yellow, so that when someone is examining that license, there's a color that helps identify what privileges their license invokes. And so this red stripe would be on the license of a person who's been convicted of drunk driving and ordered not to drink for the period that that order exists.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. You're referring only to DWI folks. What if someone's a chronic alcohol abuser and involved in domestic violence? Would they also then be required to get the Scarlett A license?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we did examine that and in previous iterations of the bill considered expanding it to include any person who's been court ordered not to drink. The fiscal note for that was astronomical. There already exists a method but right now by which the courts automatically communicate with the Department of Motor Vehicles on drunk driving offenses. And so adding the red stripe to drunk driving offenders doesn't generate much cost. It's an additional checkbox on a form. Unfortunately, the court system isn't capable at this time of communicating all of those orders to the DMV. The DMV is not set up to receive those communications, so the sponsor determined that it was probably in the best interest of getting the bill passed to limit it to the most doable option, if you will.
Senator?
Yeah, and so someone's convicted of DWI. How does the court communicate that to DMV if this bill were law?
There is a form that they send over to the DMV to let the person know that there has been a DUI conviction because in most instances, there's a license revocation involved with a DUI conviction. So this would just go along with that paperwork.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd note that Mr. Dwayne Bannock and Carrie Hennings of DMV are available to answer questions if any come up. But we also have O.C. Madden and Mr. Ed O'Neill online. Mr. O'Neill, and I'm not sure if O.C. Madden, I'm not sure of a gender there.
Mr. Madden.
O.C. Madden or yes. Ed O'Neill.
Right.
Please go ahead.
We just see a lot of benefit in this legislation, especially with the help of judicial and with our bush orders we send out if it's expanded to go beyond just DWIs. A lot of sexual abuse in the villages and a lot of these towns are small. You kind of know who you're dealing with and you don't have to card every person, but if the person that you know has an issue with it, we turned down over 100 attempts to purchase every day at Brown Jar throughout the chain. And so we see a tremendous benefit from this legislation. We feel very comfortable with it. Be glad to answer any questions anybody might have.
Okay, just for the record, is that Mr. Madden speaking?
That's Ed O'Neill.
Oh, that's Ed. Okay, hi, Ed. So Ed O'Neill of Brown Jug. Any questions for Mr. O'Neill? Senator Bundy?
Yes. Hi, Mr. O'Neill. When you get a bush order, do they include a driver's license or what form of ID? Because obviously everyone in the bush does not drive.
Well, it's either state ID or driver's license. It's in the system and it's scanned into the system now. And hopefully we'll be sharing this with the competitors as well to further control the amount of beverage alcohol that goes to individuals.
All right.
And with all of the abuse, I mean, 1 in 5 people between, the age of 15 and...
9 and 18
are abused, and we just are nationwide. We just have these huge issues with alcohol abuse, so we just see this as another tool to do our community-minded efforts,
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. You mentioned the state ID. Now, if someone had a DWI and their driver's license had the red mark, couldn't they use a state ID instead?
This applies to the state ID, as I understand it, as well.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Beatty, could you confirm that on the record?
I'd be happy to. Senator Bundy, through the chair, the bill does apply to both state ID cards and driver's licenses. What would happen is that at the hearing, the judge sentences the offender not to consume alcohol for 6 months a year. Their current driver's license and state ID card would be confiscated. They would go to the DMV and whichever or both, if they choose to receive, would have the red mark. So we will, we've done our best to capture everyone under the bill.
Okay, Ms. Beatty, thank you. Mr. O'Neill, thank you for your testimony and for the leadership you show in the liquor industry on these issues and your community service. We appreciate it. Did Mr. Madden want to make any comments?
No, I think Ed covered it. You know, since we've had the civil penalty law in effect dealing with minors, we've actually intercepted 1,700 kids and taken civil action against these kids since the bill went into effect in 1998. It's been a really good tool for us, and I think it's really benefited the community, and there's no way to really gauge how many lives have been saved or changed by those efforts, and we couldn't have done it without the legislation. And
yeah, that was some good work we did together, and we appreciate you helping implement.
So I would just strongly urge passage of this measure for the same reasons.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. And I have a question. I certainly appreciate the work both of you do to try to reduce alcohol abuse. I'm concerned that the people who are trying to escape this problem would require then bars and package stores to virtually card everyone with this bill were passed, because if you didn't card and you served to someone who was prohibited from serving or from purchasing alcohol, it seems as if it would put the business in a very liable position. Is that correct?
My understanding is that there is no liability for a licensee unless they know with absolute certainty that the person has the red stripe on their license. If they know the person has a red stripe on the license and they serve them anyway, there would be liability. But unless they knew, there would be no liability for the licensee. And my understanding is that there's no responsibility on part of the licensee as part of this measure to force 100% carding on all customers.
But I'm wondering, if I might, Mr. Chairman, if the practical realities are you don't card and you serve someone, I'm sure there will be a lawyer knocking on your door. If this will just encourage the vast majority of people who dispense alcohol to, and I find it very irritating to be carded, so at my advanced age. So,
so I understand just, there's not an increased liability by this measure, that this legislation doesn't create an additional liability for the licensee.
Ms. Beatty?
If I may, Mr. Chair, there are two memos from Legal Services in the packet, because the concern of adding additional liability to an industry that frankly already has quite a bit of criminal and civil liability out there was not the intent of the sponsor. And both memos, each addressing criminal and civil liability, do state that there isn't an additional liability placed on this. Of course, as Senator Bundy pointed out, a creative and determined lawyer will likely try to pursue that. The only assurance we can give you is that our legal department does not believe we're adding any liability, and until that's proven in court, there's no definitive answer to your concerns. But it has been stated on the record in every committee, in every hearing, that the intent of both the committee's hearing it and of the sponsor is not to increase the liability.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone further online or here in the Belch Room who would like to testify on this bill at this time? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 14. Ms. Beatty, anything in wrap-up?
Not unless there are any further questions. Okay. No, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? If not, that brings the bill back before us for discussion. It hardly needs to be said. We all know it's that time of year if bills are... this is a bill from the other body that does have a chance to pass this year. Is there any discussion of the legislation? Senator Bundy?
Well, I just maintain my concern, and it's been articulated very clearly by the sponsor's representative that a determined and creative attorney will certainly, I think, find ways to try to squeeze money out of an establishment that served one of these people.
Yeah. And this bill, if it leaves here today, goes on to Senate Judiciary and Senate Finance, and has a road to hoe here to get to the floor. So I personally would wish you luck with that, and I will ask what is the will of the committee at this time.
Mr. Chairman, we have before us a CS.
Yes.
But there is no proposed CS.
No CS for us.
For us, no.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move out CS for House Bill number 14 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. I would note good bipartisan cooperation, it appears, on this bill, and appreciate you bringing it before us and working on the problem. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill moves on. Good luck with your bill.
Thank you, Senators.
Okay. That brings us to House Bill 113, Optometrist Use of Pharmaceuticals. The sponsor is Representative Ralph Samuels. And I know he has a staffer here, or he's on his way. So we'll have the welcome Representative Samuels to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee.
I was just making the motion to adjourn. Oh, man, you
just under the wire. Good afternoon. Let me tell you the game plan here. We're going to take your presentation of the bill. This is the first time we've had the bill before us. Then I'm going to mention some amendments that I've had drafted here in case the committee wants to pursue them. Some may be offered, some may not, depending on the will of the committee. We have a number of people signed up to testify. We can go over our allotted time schedule a little bit, but I don't want to lose my quorum. So if we can keep that in mind and proceed forward. So Representative Samuels, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I will be very brief to let the people that do this for a living come and give you the various sides of the issue here. What House Bill 113 attempts to do is open access to health care for more Alaskans, and that when you cut to the crux of the bill, that's what we're trying to do. 45 other states let optometrists do more than they do here. 90% of the United States has the line drawn where optometrists can act in a different place than we do. And if there's any one state in a country that probably needs it because of the geographic size that Alaska has and the small population, we have more problems with access than I think in any other state in the country. So if any place needs this, I think that Alaska does. And there's going to be a lot of argument you're going to hear back and forth from the people that follow me in testimony on where exactly to draw that line. And you're going to hear about educational experience of these two different groups that are kind of battling this out. But the bottom line is that the bill moves the line from over here to over here somewhere, and you can argue about where exactly to draw it, but I think that it needs to move. It will help the access to health care for Alaskans, and with that, Mr. Chairman, I will allow that the people that are lined up to testify to come forward.
Okay. Representative Samuels, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hang on just a second. Are there any questions or comments for the sponsor? I guess I have one. You asked, or you suggested that a large number of other states allow optometrists to do more than our current statute allows. How many, do you happen to know the number of how many allow exactly what's proposed in the current version of this bill?
Dr. Bennett could probably speak to that better.
Okay.
I'm sure you'll hear a couple different versions on that, but
okay.
I don't know. I would think that we're probably in the legislation a little bit more than the average, but nowhere near the top, and that's
okay.
Just me kind of shooting from.
Well, the folks who've listened can answer that question when they give their testimony, and let me say here to expedite the process, if that's what we choose to do, and to keep us organized, I have drafted three amendments that I could offer, not offer, allow someone else to have as options before the committee. And so I wanted to lay those out here, and we're going to pass those out, Dana, to the members. and see if you have any reaction to these. You need not. I mean, but I just wanted to be able to get through the testimony, and if people want to comment, give their testimony, comment on the amendments, potential amendments, and then we can consider those in markup. So we won't have to have people testify more than once. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I believe ophthalmologists can do what you are asking for optometrists to do. I believe that's true, but and maybe you can answer that. But also, I'd be looking for the answer of are there many ophthalmologists in Alaska? I don't think there are.
Through the chair, and you'll hear the testimony. Roughly 20 ophthalmologists. There are some ophthalmologists that travel from out of state up here and do some kind of a circuit. They can answer that question better than I do. And I don't have the exact numbers of the optometrists, but I believe it's north of 90. And once again, the optometrists who come up here will be able to answer that,
okay,
that question exactly.
Okay. Yeah, we'll just throw out our questions here, and folks who know the answers can,
yes,
can fill us in when they come forward.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. If I could look at the amendments,
sure,
then I can either myself.
Sure.
I've got another.
Anything I heard
up in finance, and I'm supposed to be in one committee, so
I understand. It's that time of year.
Kind of tell you what we're.
I just heard a number of things and said, let's get these amendments prepared so we wouldn't have to, you know, wait on drafting. The first one should be on the top of your pile is /V1 Bullard. And this amendment would provide any pharmaceutical allowed to be prescribed by an optometrist under this legislation would first have to be approved for that use by the state medical board. Now, that's a big point of contention, I understand, from the two sides of this argument. And the argument is made and may well be made in testimony that this would preclude, that people don't think the state medical board would approve of any of these being prescribed by optometrists because of their point of view or their interpretation of the public interest. So that, you know, I understand all this is controversial. So that's one option. It's just an option. I'm not offering that at this time.
I ask the question, or you just want to go through all of them?
I was just going to go through all of them.
Okay.
And then
fine.
Let the sponsor know, and then people can testify.
Okay.
During markup, we would come back to them.
Okay.
The second one is V/V.2. This amendment would prohibit all injections by optometrists. I think in the other body and with some of our members, the injection, you know, the topical application of topical treatments and things in the eye didn't seem to raise a lot of concern, at least with me, but the injections seemed to be a point of contention. So this amendment would prohibit all injections by optometrists. And then the third option, that's V.3 Bullard. This amendment would prohibit the injection of Botox by optometrists. And I've, from the discussions I've had, I've heard the optometrists don't want to be in cosmetic procedure business. I understand there's a lot of money to be made there, but if they don't want to be involved in that, this amendment would clarify that. That was one that I was personally interested in. The others are just options. Any comments on those? Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on number one, I would agree with your assessment of it. If you say yes, you can do this. If I tell you yes later, but I'm going to tell you no, then I'd be opposed to the First Amendment you had on the State Medical Board.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, on that.
Well, we're at that point. Mm-hmm. Is there another board that might be that you might support, like an whatever they are?
There's a board. There's a board of optometry through the chair.
Optometry.
A board of optometry that could review that.
Thank you.
The conflict between these two groups is, as you have all known, as I'm sure you've been lobbied to death on this bill, that the conflict between the two, I think, would make that not practical.
And Senator Davis, was your comment on the First Amendment or another one?
Yeah, I was going to ask if you had spoke with the medical board, because as far as I know, they would not agree to this.
I haven't spoken to them, though.
Okay.
Senator Bundy, on this First Amendment?
I have a question for the sponsor when we have a moment. I plead guilty to oversimplification often. But would it be fair to characterize this bill in some, or the discussion about this bill in some fashion, as turf battles? You've got some people who want more business, and you want other people who don't want business taken away from them.
Through the chair, Senator Muddy, that is how I would characterize it. There are people sitting in this room behind me who would not characterize it this way, but I would say that is an accurate description of this battle that's going on.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and did you have any comments on the other amendments?
The amendment three, I think, sounds pretty reasonable. I hadn't thought through it. And amendment two, the debate on the House floor, as well as in the House Pest Committee, you were talking about the injections into an eyelid, and some of the debate on that centered around you could have an optometrist who spends their entire career every day, all day, dealing with the eyes that could not do something that a general practitioner then could do, and it seemed that it was an odd mix to say this person can do that and this person could not do that. I think between the optometrist and the ophthalmologist that are going to testify behind me, they can probably better clarify in a medical term how often they do that, what risks, if any, are there, and once again, opening the access to the healthcare system by allowing the larger number of doctors to do just a little bit more. If I had a vote on the committee, I would vote no on amendment number two. Amendment number one guts the bill, quite frankly. Amendment number two, I would let the debate continue on. If I had a vote on the committee, I would be voting no on amendment number two. But the doctors that are all behind me on various sides of the issue can probably explain in better terms what all is involved with an injecting into an eyelid.
Okay. Representative Samuels, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and my staff can come and grab me wherever in the building I am if you have any more questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd note that we have 8 or 9 folks signed up to testify. I don't want to go much beyond 3 o'clock if we can possibly help it. I would note for the record that Mr. Jill Matheson of the Optometry Board is available here in Juneau for questions. So are there any questions at this time for Jill Matheson? Okay, she's standing by for questions if those arise. I guess we will just go in the order that people have signed up. First is Dr. Chinati?
Yes.
Please go ahead and correctly pronounce your name and your affiliation and go right ahead.
Sure. Dr. Donald Chinati. I'm representing the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I'm the chairman of the State Governmental Relations Committee for the Academy. I'm also a clinical associate professor in ophthalmology at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in Newark, New Jersey. I'm second vice president of the state of New Jersey's Medical Society, chairman of the State Society's Scope of Practice Committee, a delegate to the AMA, and on the task force of the AMA on Scope of Practice. My expertise is in scope of practice and in ophthalmology. I have been a professor and trained residents in ophthalmology for 26 years. We battle across the country in every state, as you've already heard. Our main concern is, when does an optometric degree, a graduate of optometry school, become an ophthalmologist? In every state, in every legislative session, bills continue to pop up to increase the scope of practice of optometry. This bill is far above the average around the country for optometry. It's one of the most liberal bills, and it essentially makes an optometrist, if it goes through in its form, a ophthalmologist who doesn't do surgery. And I'd like to go over some of the myths that we see and we hear. The multiple states, the reason for expansion of optometric scope of practice always comes down to testimony in access, training, and it's a turf battle. The access issue. Every state, even New Jersey, when we faced these bills, the optometrist said there's an access problem, that they have to refer a patient to an ophthalmologist to get care. Now, I think you all have to be honest in the number of calls that you receive in your offices over the years. When do you get calls from your constituents saying that they have no access to eye care? How often does that happen? The only time you hear is when these bills are up in front of you and the optometrists get their patients and they make these phone calls that poor patients are not getting eye care. Rural communities have taken care of access in all fields of medicine for time immemorial. We do it by having the physicians, the optometrists, the emergency rooms. We'll have friendly ophthalmologists who they call and will be guided through the care of the patient and told what patients need to be referred in and what patients a prescription can be called into. So there really is no access problem in any state in this country. Second, training. As I said, I've been training ophthalmology residents for 26 years. I'd like to just think about this. Ophthalmology has been cutting down its residency programs over the years. All of the small programs have been ended. The majority of programs now are very highly supervised. Around the country, the standards, the what is taught and how many patients are being seen is all standardized. The average, let's take the average ophthalmology residency program, a three-year program, would have five residents per year, so that's 15 residents. The average resident sees about 10 to 15 patients a day, so if we take the small number, that would be 15 times 10, or 150 patients a day would have to be seen in the clinic to qualify for the standards that we set, plus the patients that they see on call, night call, weekends calls. If you were going to take an optometric program, average of optometric program, they have many more students of 60 per year. It's 4 years. That would be 240 students times 10 patients, or 2,400 patients a day to be equivalent to the experience that an ophthalmology resident has during their training. And then we go into pathology. The ophthalmology residency programs see a tremendous amount of pathology every day. They are supervised from medical school through residency by another ophthalmologist, by someone who has more training. All of their prescriptions are looked at before they are written. So in medicine, we have always learned and been trained before we were given the right to prescribe. What this bill and all of the expansion bills around the country do is they get the right to prescribe, and then we worry about how they're going to be trained, whether it's going to be a weekend course or how much training do they need to take. We have specific concerns about several of the portions of this bill, especially in the oral medications with off-label use. Many diseases now, especially uveitis, which is an inflammation inside the eye, are now being treated with anti-cancer drugs. Is an optometrist trained to be prescribing anti-cancer drugs? Are they going to know the side effects around the rest of the body and be able to handle that? Are they going to be required to have medical consultations? Are all of their patients who are being treated having to be seen by medical doctors? We're concerned about the use of medications in the pediatric population. There is no equivalent between a child and a baby and a newborn to an adult. The doses are completely different, and the danger is extremely high. This bill allows an optometrist to treat a baby who is 1 hour old or to the rest of their life. We're extremely concerned about lack of training in the pediatric population and understanding how drugs are going to affect this. We're concerned about what we've seen in other states. We've seen in many states we've tracked the prescriptions that optometrists are writing. We've looked at three states, and we found that in a lot of states they're writing prescriptions that they're not entitled to. We found in Illinois they were writing for Viagra, they were writing for birth control pills, completely different than what they said that they were going to write for. We're concerned that these prescriptions are going to be given to drug addicts. Ophthalmologists, medical doctor graduates have training in psychiatry, have training in recognizing when a patient is in the office complaining about something that they're really looking for drugs. Where is the optometrist going to get the training to prescribe the narcotics? Are they going to recognize if a patient is a drug addict? Also, people who prescribe narcotics have a much higher incidence of addiction. The highest addiction rate in medicine is in anesthesiology. Are optometrists, by prescribing narcotics, are they going to have an increase in rate of addiction in these practitioners? Are you going to have an impaired program for optometrists now that they have this new prescription? Ophthalmologists in general do not write narcotics. I can't remember the last patient I wrote a narcotic for, and I ran the trauma service for the university for 15 years. And we managed pain with topical drops. We did not give patients too many narcotics.
Doctor, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize, please.
Okay. We in medicine feel that these bills, and this bill in particular, is creating a medical graduate from an optometrist without the education. We understand the difficulty that you have in Alaska with the rural population, but we know that those people have been taken care of. And I think it's difficult for you to talk to your constituents and really say to them, hey, today we did a good job. We got you second best. We got you almost as good to take care of your eyes. And we in medicine feel that it is so important, the training, the difference in training. We must keep this as medical and not create another class of physician, doctor, MD. Thank you.
Thank you, doctor. Next is Bob Loescher. Bob, if you could go ahead and come to the table. Then we're going Bob Loescher is next, and then I'm going to call on Dr. Steiner. Mr. Loescher, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Loescher. I live at 10645 Misty Lane, Juneau, Alaska. I'm a resident and a consumer of health services. I've sent each of the committee members a letter from myself regarding this issue in opposition to this legislation. And I don't know if I've sent to you, Mr. Chairman, a copy of the Central Council of the Tlingit Indians resolution.
We do have it.
Thank you. And I'd like you to recognize that for the record. Mr. Chairman, I am legally blind. As a result of diabetes and other medical kidney transplant and whatnot. And I've spent maybe over $250,000 on my health, including my eyes. I have a lot of experience with ophthalmologists and optometrists. I've had 9 eye surgeries on my eyes and many other treatments. And so as a consumer, I want to express a few things about my experience and what I'm concerned about in this legislation. First of all, as a lifelong Alaskan, I've traveled all over Alaska. I've been everywhere. I've done quite a few things. And I've done my best to help people throughout Alaska in their housing and their health and jobs and energy and whatnot. And so I know, and I've also built some medical clinics in the rural communities. And what I'm concerned about, Mr. Chairman, is that we should not diminish the quality of health care or the safety of health delivery to any Alaskan, whether they live in an urban area, a semi-urban area, or a rural area. And I think that's really one of the main premises that I'm here to speak on this legislation. This is a consumer protection issue. I'm more concerned about people who need services of ophthalmologists and optometrists, but they have to do it. One, they have to be qualified to provide the medical service. And they have to have the right training. They have to have the right legal qualifications to dispense drugs and to do injections in the eye. And I really believe that the legislature should protect consumers in these areas. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, that I'm concerned about is I've followed all these hearings, and I'm perplexed, actually, by the way government is working. This is the Committee of Jurisdiction for Labor and Commerce. But we have the optometry board over here saying one thing. We have the ophthalmologist board over here saying something. And the state medical board doesn't want to deal with this. And as a consumer, what I'm concerned about is that these are the people that are charged with the responsibility of ensuring that Alaskans get qualified practitioners, and we have qualified facilities, and we have qualified treatment programs, whatever they might be, that these practitioners provide. And I don't believe that we Alaskans have been well served by these boards because they are not coming forth with a unified, uniform opinion about the subject that you're legislating on. And we, the public, we, the consumers, have to rely on these people. And for some reason, they won't come forward and provide us the advice and what we need, particularly the state medical board. And I think that's really important for this committee to get a handle on. Because I think we Alaskans need the proper advice, and our legislators need to have that advice when they're considering this kind of legislation. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, that I've seen through the committee process, there is no fiscal note here anywhere. And certainly there are going to be costs to the Department of Commerce as they work with the optometrists. If they get their way in this legislation, they're going to have to file more applications and more certifications and more testing and whatnot, and that there is no fiscal note here that deals with those issues. The other thing is there is impact to the state medical delivery programs, Medicaid. There is no fiscal note that I have seen that deals with the young people and the old people that are going to be impacted by this legislation. Certainly it's an expansion of the service, and certainly there will be increased costs. So I believe that this committee or some committee should examine the costs and impacts to the state, to the Department of Commerce, and to our medical programs. And I'd urge you to consider that aspect of the program. Anyway, in sort of conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I know from my own experience that the eyes are the pathway to your total body health. Your eyes cannot be disassociated with the rest of your body in terms of your total health, the individual's total health. Every part of your body reacts to one part or another. And certainly with my kidney transplant experience, I've learned, and my diabetic experience, I've learned that the eyes can be greatly affected by these other organs. And what I'm concerned about, and my experience teaches me, that you need a fully qualified medical doctor to deal with your comprehensive health, including your eyes. You cannot delink your eyes from the rest of the body. And what I'm concerned about is that Alaskans receive treatment by qualified doctors to make sure that you not only treat your eyes, but you make sure that the rest of your body is managed carefully, and that any drugs or pills or other treatments that you have are coordinated, so that you don't receive further damage to your total health. So, Mr. Chairman, to wrap up, we rely on this committee of jurisdiction to take a look at some of these issues, and we would hope that you would do so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Loescher. We appreciate you being with us, and I apologize that we were not able to accommodate Dr. Steiner's surgery schedule. He has submitted written testimony. Okay, that brings us to, we're going to take one or two more from each side, and then get to the amendments. Michael Benetton. Michael Bennett OD. Okay.
I don't have the best penmanship.
Well, that's the case with a lot of these doctors here on this list.
I was doomed from third grade on.
Please be mindful, we're running out of time. So.
I will keep it brief. I'm Dr. Mike Bennett. I'm a Juno optometrist. I'm here to represent the 107 optometrists in the state of Alaska. I'm the current president of the Alaska Optometric Association. And as mentioned before, Dr. Matheson is here to answer any questions as regard to board type activities. I'd like to urge your support for House Bill 113. It's going to authorize licensed and trained optometrists to prescribe medications by additional routes for the treatment of eye and surrounding tissues. That's stipulated directly in the bill, that this is for treatment only of eye and surrounding tissues, and not for birth control or other purposes, and very limited pain medications, somewhat limited pain medications for very brief periods of time. 4 days is the length of time that you could authorize a pain medication or a narcotic pain medication, any of the scheduled drugs under this bill. Also provides for the treatment of anaphylactic shock, which can occur in real rare instances, but following the topical administration of drugs. And I see that as a very critical part of this bill, so that you can, anaphylactic shock people can die from, and it can happen in the office. Fortunately, it's never happened in my office. But if it does happen in your office under current law, you would be bound to treat the patient illegally, or let them die on the floor if in those circumstances. So I view that as a very critical part of the bill. It is quite narrow in scope. It does not allow prescription of the most abused controlled substances, such as OxyContin. Specifically prohibits injections inside the eye. It in no way grants surgical privileges, and it mandates continuing education and competency. The course work that is mandated in here is meant as refresher coursework. It is not intended to teach somebody off the street how to prescribe medication for eye care. So the inference that somehow we know nothing about these things is simply not accurate. We've been well qualified for these rights for quite a long time. We are a doctoral level profession. That's 4 rigorous years beyond a bachelor's degree. Optometry school provides over 200 hours of classroom pharmacology, which is comparable, in some cases more so, than the pharmacology training in medical and dental schools. There is greater than 2,000 hours of supervised patient care. These patients are not limited to the young and the healthy. Elderly people and folks with serious illnesses form the preponderance of most eye care practices. People with debilitating diseases are far more likely to have serious eye health problems, and they form the bulk of most practices. So you see lots of those folks. My own training included clinical rotations in a VA hospital, where you see plenty of very, very ill people. Complete medical case history has always been taken on every patient I've ever seen. Medications are looked at, interactions considered, and new medications, drops or otherwise, are looked at for interactions. If there's any questions or concerns about that, you certainly contact the patient's primary care physician before you proceed with that. With current law, when you see a patient who requires an oral antibiotic or an antiviral or something that's covered by this, they must either be referred to an eye surgeon or to their primary care doctor, a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, to get the prescription covered. Many times what happens is, it's the end of the day, you end up trying to call the patient's physician, their primary care physician, get them to call in the prescription to cover it. That's an awkward situation for that physician to do, or if they see them having almost no medical eye training, specific training, it's difficult for them to make that diagnosis if an eye surgeon is not available. Generally, it results in a wait of a day or two at least for the patient to see them. Results in unnecessary travel, always results in delayed treatment. There's additional fees and additional lost time at work. If we are allowed to write these prescriptions, it does not result in, it's certainly an additional cost, it results in cost savings, because when I see a patient and then have to refer them for that treatment, I make the diagnosis, I bill their insurance, the patient gets charged for that procedure. There's not, it doesn't cost any more if you're able to write the prescription for them. So it does not result in increased income to optometrist of any significance at all, and it certainly would saves cost as far as not having to send them somewhere else.
Were you about to wrap up there? Senator Bundy is going to have a question when you're finished.
Yeah.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
I'll get to look at Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. Certainly your office visit wouldn't cost any more, but wouldn't you anticipate more patients if this bill were to pass?
No, not really. Patients are not aware that I can treat their glaucoma and I can treat their eye infection with topical drops, but that I can't necessarily treat an infection that's spread a little further into the eyelid with an oral antibiotic. I would question if there's a handful of patients in the state that understand that. When you speak with general practitioner physicians, many of them are shocked that you can't do this. So the patient comes into your office anyway, or to their provider of their choice, but if they come into my office, they're assuming that I can take care of the problem. So no. I mean, a lot has been made of the idea that these things that we're talking about are not run-of-the-mill, everyday occurrences, and that's absolutely true. I can't give you a frequency on how often that I would write a prescription for an oral antibiotic, but I can tell you it wouldn't be one a week. It would not be a common thing. Not very many people require that. As far as the pain medications go, absolutely right. It's very unusual that you would need that. And I think with me being here in Juneau or somebody in Anchorage, it would be extremely rare that you would ever have to do that. A good example, though, would be if you're up in Kotzebue and a battery blows up in somebody's face. That person's going to need to get to Anchorage, and it would be awfully nice if you could provide them some pain relief for a day or two until they could get there.
A follow-up.
Quickly, sure.
Would it be fair to say that an office visit to an optometrist would have a different rate than an office visit to an ophthalmologist?
I can tell you averages, yes, fees are probably somewhat lower.
An informed consumer will then find where the lower rate is. And so, indeed, you would have more business, I'm guessing.
Okay, thank you, Senator Bundy. There are a number of other people signed up to testify. We have taken, I'll characterize, major representations of both sides of this issue. There's some people here without affiliations. I don't know which side they fall on. I regret, and we will keep the public hearing open. But at this time, I'd like to turn to these amendments that could be before the committee. They're just options. And anything else from Dr. Bennett? If not, thank you for...
Very brief question.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Doctor. The first person testifying talked about his concern about optometrists writing prescriptions for drugs other than for the eye. He talked about, specifically he mentioned Viagra because of that. He also mentioned narcotics that would be beyond the use of the eye. Do you see this as encompassing anything more than just medication for the eye?
It specifically states in the bill that it's specifically for treatment of eye disorders only.
So the comments that you would be supplying narcotic addicts with things is not really legitimate, you don't think?
Correct, and you couldn't help an addict very much with a four-day with a four-day legal dose.
And then we'll get to the issue, I guess, of the amendment. So thank you, Doctor.
Okay, let's turn to the amendments here and see what we can accomplish here. The first one, V1, that was the amendment that would provide that any pharmaceutical allowed to be prescribed by an optometrist would first have to be approved for that use by the state medical board. Some people would argue that that's a reasonable thing or precaution to have, the state medical board making this decision. Others argue that that means that nothing would ever happen because of the interests involved, the state medical board toward this practice or subspecialty or specialty. I just had this drafted in case the committee wanted to pursue this. The second amendment, and I speak up if there's any interest or further. Senator Stevens.
It just seems to me that, unless I'm misunderstanding this entirely, that it might be more appropriate that the Board of Optometry be involved in this, though it doesn't sound to me like the number of prescriptions can be given would be out of the ordinary anyway for eye treatment. So, I mean, if you do want to go to this amendment, I'd suggest an amendment to the amendment to make it the Board of Optometry.
Well, let's ask Jill Matheson to come forward.
They're already in clause.
Well, that's what I thought. But, Ms. Matheson, could you come forward? Would there be, you heard Senator Stevens, would there be any utility or would it just be a redundancy to have this amendment but changing the state medical board to the state board of, or the state optometric board?
The statute before us.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, I'm Jill Matheson, Dr. Matheson, Jill Matheson from the optometry board. The statute as it is written is an optometry statute which is then automatically regulated by the optometry board. So by putting the that would be unprecedented to have the medical board have jurisdiction over what optometrists do, and that could open. I mean, we have. It's not. I mean, that doesn't happen anywhere else, and I don't know if there's unforeseen things that could happen in other boards if that were to happen. If that would open a can of worms.
Okay,
elsewhere.
So that would be plowing new ground.
And if I could follow up on that.
But would it, excuse me just a second, would it be a redundancy then to say the state optometric board because it's already an optometric statute?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, right. Senator Stevens?
No, that's fine.
Did that answer? Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize. Okay, anything else for Ms. Matheson? Okay, thank you for being with us. Let's set aside that amendment unless someone wants to press the issue. The second is V.2. This is the amendment that would prohibit all injections by optometrists.
A question on that.
Senator Stevens.
If you look on page 3, line 23, 24, 25, 24, 25, it already says, is not injected in the ocular globe of the eye. Isn't this amendment already in? Or do I misunderstand?
Can you come on up? My understanding is it's the matter of injecting into the eye or around the eye. Is that the issue? If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, I'm Sydney Morgan, staff to Representative Samuels. Yes, the bill does specifically address no injections directly into the eyeball. That's what it specifies.
So this amendment is more expansive in prohibiting all injections by optometrists.
Correct. There were some changes made in the last committee regarding injections, and that was that one, immediately they were going to allow injections for anaphylactic shock, which absolutely makes sense. If someone has just gone into anaphylactic shock, of course you want a doctor to treat that. Heck, I can treat it. My friend goes into it. But then what it did was it also allowed, it took the injections, which the original bill allowed, but then put an effective date on it that allowed.
Oh, that's what you did.
Yes. It allowed for the optometry board to ensure that everyone was educated and trained properly for those injections, even though we believe that's already the case.
Okay, so that was the good work of the Senate Hess Committee.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor's representative? Okay, is there any interest? I know you've got a time crunch.
But you can call me at any time. I'll come up for a moment.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's move. I'm going to set that one aside with that explanation having been made. So there's been some accommodation there of that concern. The third is V.3 by Bullard. This is the amendment that I do plan to offer, prohibiting the injection of Botox by optometrists and not turning optometric offices into cosmetic procedure offices.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
was brought
Senator
up.
Davis.
Before, it was pointed out to me that it doesn't say anywhere in the bill that they would be doing that, but the people that spoke to me said they had no problem with this amendment.
Okay, that's my understanding as well. Some people were concerned about it. The word I got back from the optometrists I spoke with, or their representatives, was that this was not an objectionable amendment from their perspective. So, Senator Bundy?
That's maybe a friendly amendment to the amendment that they wouldn't do body piercing either, but perhaps I'll withdraw that.
Now, I thought you got all those body piercing jokes out of your system when I sponsored the first bill to license that whole hepatitis situation. No, thank you, Senator Bundy. I appreciate that. I will offer what we're going to title Amendment Number 1,
okay,
which is the Botox amendment. I've offered the amendment. Is there a discussion of Amendment Number 1? Is there any objection to Amendment Number 1? Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. Under markup, is there any other amendment that the committee would like to consider at this time? If not, we're over our time limit. We have accommodated testimony on both sides of the issue and from the state folks. Is there further discussion of this bill by this committee at this time? It is that time of the year, and I will defer to the will of the committee if someone would like to consider action.
I will make an a motion that we move CS4 House Bill. I'm not looking at the right bill. Yeah, 113. Out of the committee with individual recommendations. And there's no note attached to the bill.
Correct. There's a motion before us. Yeah, there is a zero fiscal note. That's right. No cost, but a zero fiscal note. I guess I would like to say this is always a difficult time of the session. I personally feel a bit conflicted about this and wish we would have had more time together to consider these issues and accommodate all the public testimony. But it is that time of year, and I will defer to the will of the committee. So the motion has been made. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill moves on to the next committee of referral, where I expect there will be further discussion of the bill. Thank you all for being with us today.